Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Shalach. The podcast website, which is podcasts.pardesusa.org, has a full set of categories for all 400 odd podcasts that we've broadcast so far. So if you're planning a talk about a given parsha, you may want to do what some listeners do, which is go to the podcast website and look under the parsha, where you'll see five or six different podcasts about that same parsha. You can use them for ideas for your talk about the parsha of the week. And if you want to even closer experience with the Pardes faculty, then I urge you to think about coming this summer to the Pardes Summer Program. It will be held here in Jerusalem, July 7th through 25th, 3 weeks of dynamic interactive study of the Jewish texts in a vibrant community of students from around the world. Grapple with the great Jewish books and ideas, experience how classic Judaism tackles contemporary challenges, and be inspired by our renowned faculty. For more information about the summer program in Israel, visit www.pardes.org.il/summer and tell them Larry sent you. This week, Shalach with Rabbi Meir Schweiger. Rabbi Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Shlach. The main topic of the parsha is the sin of the spies, a sin which results in a whole generation dying in the desert, which results in the Jews wandering for 40 years in the desert. Today I would like to examine this story in light of a parallel, which I would like to draw between the opening stories of the book of Bereishit and the opening sections of the book of Bamidbar. To be more specific, a parallel which I would like to draw between the sin of the spies and the sin of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Before we look at our parsha, we need to see it in the larger context of the opening sections of Bamidbar. In previous podcasts, I have discussed how the opening sections of Bamidbar, from chapter 1 through chapter 10, are organizing the Jewish people in such a way that it's preparing them to enter the land of Israel. Towards that end, there are censuses which is taken. One census of the general Jewish population, two censuses of the Levites. Each of the tribes are arranged, structured around the tabernacle. Each of the families of the Levites are arranged around the tabernacle. The camp of the Jewish people is very, very clearly organized so that not only each tribe, but each family, and I might even argue each individual, knows exactly what his place is in this camp and what his role is. And at the end of chapter 10, after everything has been put in place, the Jews begin to embark on their journey, led by the cloud, a journey which should ultimately culminate in their entry into the land of Israel. If we step back for a moment, we can see a very interesting parallel to the beginning of the book of Bereishit, chapter 1. In chapter 1, the world is created in a very structured, methodical way. Everything that is made has its place. Hence, throughout the process of creation, the phrase that repeats itself again and again, Ki tovu, it is good, ultimately culminating in God looking at all of creation on the sixth day and being able to say, V'hine tov ma'od, it was very good. Let us look at another parallel. In chapter 2 of Bereishit, the focus is on the Garden of Eden, and in particular, on man who was placed in the Garden of Eden and given the directive, the Ovda Ulishomra, to serve it and to guard it. When we look in chapter 3 of Bamidbar, where we take a census of the Levites, before that census is taken, we describe the role of the Levites, a role which is to guard the tabernacle, to serve it. These are the only two places in the Chumash where we have the phraseology, la'ovda u'lishomra. And hence, one can very easily draw the parallel. In the beginning of Bamidbar, a new world is being created. A new world where the Jewish people are the humanity. A new world where everything is very structured, where the center of that world is the tabernacle, similar to the Garden of Eden, and how the world at large, which complements the Garden of Eden, perhaps will be reflected in the land of Israel, in the camp of the Jews, which complements the tabernacle. And perhaps through the tabernacle, through the camp of the Jewish people, through the nation which they will create in the land of Israel, a new world order will emerge, which can actually be described, ki tovu, tov ma'od. In the same way, God wanted to create a new world order in the context of the destruction of the flood, and had Noah build an ark, and structure that ark, and bring animals into that ark, with the assumption that ultimately they would come out of the ark, repopulate the world, and through the experience of the ark, create a better world, a more perfect world. God now attempts a third time to create a new structure, to get it ready. In certain ways, the Jews in the desert are like Noah on the ark, poised, ready to eventually come out or come in and create a new world order. Perhaps this time around, one that will succeed in achieving the goal of furthering the will of God in the world, reflecting God in the world. But unfortunately, we have another parallel. Just as in the book of Bereshit, as soon as the structure is set up, immediately there is a breakdown, which happens in the Garden of Eden story. So too, in Bamidbar, immediately after the structure has been set up, and we're all ready to now have it become a reality, from chapter 11 on, there are a series of stories that ultimately unravel the structure. And what I would like to do now is to perhaps look more carefully at the Garden of Eden story and see certain parallels, primarily to our parsha, but also to elements which appear in chapters 11 and 12 of Bamidbar. So let us begin with the first element, and that is the snake in the Garden of Eden. And in particular, I want to focus on one aspect of the snake, and that is speech. The rabbis always see the snake as somehow symbolizing Lashon Hara, evil speech. And when we look at what the snake says in chapter 3, we can see how the very opening comment of the snake, when he says to the woman, Af ki amar Elohim lo tochlu mikol eitz hagan, even if God said, do not eat of all the trees of the garden, it's a statement which is leading, a leading statement, because it's waiting for the woman to finish. Even if God said, yes, and what? And the implication might be, even if God said this, so what? But if I leave the even out, the af, for a moment, the snake would be saying, God said, do not eat of all the trees of the garden. And that statement is a total inversion of what God actually said. In fact, God said in chapter 2, From all of the fruits, or from all of the trees, you shall surely eat. This is verse 16 in chapter 2. Total inversion. And this creates confusion. And the woman's reply is, yes, we can eat of the trees. But from her comment, we already see how the actual words of God have been lost. And then the woman goes on to say, in chapter 3, verse 3, from the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God said, do not eat from it, do not touch it, lest you will die. Point by point, each phrase is false. If we go back to chapter 2, verse 9, it says, Ve'etz ha'chayim betoch hagan. The tree of life was in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The tree of life is the one that is connected, that is described as being in the midst of the garden. And that tree, they're allowed to eat. They are mandated to eat. It would seem from the verse that the tree of knowledge of good and evil is not necessarily in the midst of the garden. And that is the tree that the woman sees at the center of the garden. That is the tree that is off limits. God said, don't eat of the tree of knowledge. The woman says, do not eat, do not touch it. God said, on the day you will eat, you will surely die. The woman said, maybe we will die. And the snake goes on to say, you will not die. In chapter 3, verse 4. And he says, because God knows, on the day you eat, your eyes will be opened up and you will be godlike, knowing good and evil. What does the snake do? The snake distorts the word of God. The snake creates confusion by his speech. The result of both of those is in effect to demonize God, to create an image in the eyes and the mind of the woman of a God who is hostile, who is in a state of tension and conflict with humanity, who ultimately is not interested in the good of humanity, but is interested in putting them down, is interested in exercising his power over them. The problematic speech of the snake becomes internalized by the woman and ultimately impacts on her action. Let us now look at Bamidbar. In the very beginning of chapter 11, when the Jews begin sinning, it says in chapter 11, verse 1, Vayihi am kimit oninim. The people are mourning, complaining. It's very interesting. The Torah does not tell us what they're saying. And probably the best way to translate this is they're grumbling, bemoaning their situation. It's very interesting that Rashi says mit oninim is related to the word to'ana, which means they're looking for some pretext, something to reason to complain. And the Ramban conjectures what they could be complaining about. And the truth is, it's not hard to imagine. They're traveling through the desert. It's hot. It's tiring. It's fearsome. And there could be many things that could elicit such behavior. If we go a little bit further in chapter 11, then we begin hearing more explicitly how the Jews are crying, complaining, demanding. In chapter 11, verse 4, Mi yachilenu basar, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish that we had in Egypt for free, and the cucumbers, and the watermelons, and all the other things. And now our souls are dry. We do not have anything except for the manna. And although it is not clearly articulated. The Jews have the manna to eat. In the continuing verses, the Torah describes how great the manna is, in terms of how it looks, in terms of how it tastes, in terms of all of the care which surrounds its coming down. But it seems to be that the Jews shrug off the manna. So what if we have the manna? But that's not really fulfilling our needs. We want something else. So what if we can eat of all the trees of the garden? We can't have that tree, the tree of knowledge. And as I've said on a previous podcast, if I can't have everything, I have nothing. Note also that in this verse, it speaks of the Jews having a desire. The same word appears in the Garden of Eden. In chapter 3 of Bereshit, chapter 3, verse 6, it says, the woman looks that the tree is good to eat, and it is desirous to her eyes. Desire plays a major role here. And if I pause for one moment, there seems to be a very interesting parallel of not being happy with what one has, of having desire, wanting something which actually is not good for you, but seeing it is good. And there is a very serious problem of speech. Speech which expresses ingratitude, speech which is distorting, speech which demonizes. Speech also plays a role in chapter 12 in Bamidbar. When Miriam speaks about Moshe and the Cushite woman, and in rabbinic literature, the story of Miriam is also seen as a classic model of Lashon Hara. And although Miriam and Aaron do not demonize Moshe, perhaps they minimize Moshe by saying, did God only speak to Moshe? Did God not also speak to us? By equating themselves to Moshe, they have made an egregious error in not realizing the magnitude of Moshe, as God subsequently goes on to point out. And so now let us go to our parsha. In our parsha, speech, problematic speech, plays a major role in the report of the spies. And let us examine this a little bit closely. When the spies come back, it says that they return the word to Moshe and Aaron and to the whole congregation. They show them the fruits. And what do they say? In chapter 13 in Bamidbar, verse 27, they say, we have come to the land which you have sent us to. And yes, in fact, it is flowing with milk and honey, and this are its fruits. But then immediately, they go on to undermine everything which they said. In verse 28 and 29, they say, but the nation is tenacious that is settled in the land. The cities are fortified. The children of giants we have seen there. Amalek is sitting in the Negev. The Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are in the mountains, and the Canaanites are out by the sea. This is a classic example of manipulation of speech, of distortion. Yes, the spies are reporting back to Moshe. Yes, the spies are answering his questions. Moshe asked, is the land fat? Is the land lean? What's the nature of the fruits? What about the cities? Are they fortified? The people, are they strong? Are they many? Are they few? They answer all the questions, but they answer it in a way which has an agenda, which is very, very manipulative and deceptive. They play down the goodness of the land. There are no glowing explanations. They repeat what could be called the canned description. Yes, it is a land flowing with milk and honey. And they show the fruits without elaborating. But all of a sudden, when it comes to the dangers of warfare, the cons, they go into great detail. They describe very vividly the tenacity, the power of the people there, the fortified cities. And anybody who hears them, we can imagine, is filled with terror when they hear such a graphic description. And even more so when they make the transition between talking about the goodness of the land and the dangers that lurk. They use the word Ephes, which Nachmanides, the Ramban, translates as but. But we know in modern Hebrew the word Ephes means zero. And this is editorial comment. What they are doing is saying, yes, the land is good, and here are the fruits, but forget about it. All of that is worthless. When I weigh the goodness of the land versus the obstacles, the dangers in attaining that, it's not worth it. And then all of a sudden there begins a debate between the good spies and the bad spies. Note the fact that Kalev says, we can do it. And they say, we can't. But then what happens is, in verse 32, the spies, the bad spies, bring out a defaming of the land. They badmouth it. And in the words of the Ramban, they fabricate something. That's the meaning of lehotzi diba. To not tell it as it is, but to invent something. And what do they say? The land is a land that eats up its inhabitants. All of the people that we saw there are men of stature. And we saw this mythic race of giants. And we were as grasshoppers in our eyes and so worry in their eyes. So what do the spies do? They began by saying, yes, this is a land flowing with milk and honey. They end by saying, this is a land which eats up its inhabitants. They gave a very, very graphic description of the fearsomeness of the inhabitants in the beginning. But then they go, as we would say, ballistic in the end, by saying it's not just that we have these many different peoples and peoples who are living in fortified cities who are strong. They are all men of stature. They are part of a mythic race of giants. They are superhumans, perhaps even semi-divine beings, who it is impossible to conquer. And we are grasshoppers. And what is the response of the people when they hear this? They cry. They complain. And what do they say to Moshe? This is in chapter 14, verse 2. Would that we have died in the land of Egypt or in this desert. Why did God bring us to this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken captive, will be ravaged. Is it not better for us to return to Egypt? And then each one says to his brother, let us appoint someone and go back to Egypt. The words of the spies, like the snake, have been absorbed by the people. And one might even say the poisonous effect of those words has had its impact. And when you see what the people say, it demonizes God. Why did God bring us into a desert or bring us to this land for us to be killed by the sword? The whole purpose of the Exodus was demonical. It was in order to lead the Jews to their slaughter. If I jump just for 1 second, Joshua and Kalev respond. And in chapter 14, verse 7, the first thing which they say is, the land which we went through, searching out, Tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od, the land is very good. And now I want to say the following. In the Garden of Eden, there are two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The good tree is the tree of life. And that's the tree which they are commanded to eat of. And that's the tree which will give them immortality. The bad tree is the tree of knowledge. And they're told very clearly, if you eat of that tree, you will die. But the woman looks at the tree of knowledge, and it looks good to her. She has lost her sense of what is good and what is evil. She has inverted it. And if I take perhaps a kind of parallel to our story, there is the land of Israel. There is the land of Egypt. The land of Israel, as Joshua said, is a very good land. The land of Israel is what offers the Jews immortality, autonomy, sovereignty. The land of Egypt is the embodiment of evil, persecution, slavery. And yet all of a sudden, the land of Israel, for the Jews, becomes the symbol of evil. The place where they will die. The place where their children and women will be ravaged. And all of a sudden, the land of Egypt becomes the safe haven. In the same way that in Bamidbar, in chapter 11, the Jews have this desire, and they ignore the man, or put down the man, which is objectively good. Good in appearance, good in taste, good because it is what God is providing them with. And instead, they see the good in the food that they had in Egypt. Even though on an objective level, one could say that they had no luxuries, and it certainly did not lead to anything good in their existence. Let us now take this one step further. In the Garden of Eden, in the aftermath of eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Adam and Eve become mortal. And although they do not die immediately, they will die. And that point is accentuated when God says they need to be sent out of the garden. They need to be cut off from the tree of life. And in our story, in the aftermath of the spies, God tells Moshe, 40 years they will spend in the desert. They will be cut off from the land of Israel until a whole generation dies out. And when the Jews are dismayed by what they hear and attempt to enter the land, those who attempt to enter are thoroughly destroyed. As we see in the last verses of chapter 14 in Bamidbar. Let me end with a final point, perhaps a point of hope. In the aftermath of the Garden of Eden, God clothes Adam and Eve with kotnot or with skin tunics. This clothing is in contrast with the clothing, the fig leaf belts, that they had made after eating of the tree when they realized they were naked. The clothes which Adam and Eve make for themselves are clothes that come from a place of shame, clothes that are somehow trying to deny and run away from the sin which they had committed. The clothes which God makes them are clothes that are somehow trying to restore their human dignity, clothes that will now separate them from the animals so that that distinction is still kept very clear. And by the same token, in the aftermath of our story, the spies, the very end of Parshat Shlach speaks about tzitzit. God gives us a commandment of clothing. And as the Torah itself says in the closing verses of the Parsha, this is chapter 15, verse 39. And you will see the tzitzit, and you will remember all of the commandments of God and do them. And then it uses the phrase, velo taturu, and you will not follow, be led astray after your heart and after your eyes, asher atem zonim achareihem, that you prostitute yourselves after them. In order that you should remember and do my commandments and be holy to God. In the beginning of our parsha, the directive which is given to the spies, V'yaturu et Eretz Canaan. Let them search out, examine carefully, scrutinize the land of Canaan so that they can bring back a report. What was the sin of the spies? Perhaps it is exactly what the Torah is trying to prevent by the mitzvah of tzitzit. It says you should not, lo taturu, you should not go after your heart and your eyes. It first says your heart, then your eyes. Because the sin of the spies was that they did not look at the objective reality, but filtered what they saw through their heart. They saw what they wanted to see. And because their heart was pulling them in a certain direction, it distorted what they saw. In the same way that when the woman looked at the tree of knowledge, she saw what she wanted to see. Her desire distorted what she saw, so that the tree of knowledge all of a sudden became very pleasing in her eyes, whereas the tree of life became revolting. The tzitzit are supposed to remind us of our relationship with God, to remind us to do the commandments. And I would perhaps add to that, to remind us to see things not through the lenses of our hearts, our desire, but see things through the lenses of the will of God, so that in the end, we can perhaps see more clearly what really is good and what is evil, so that we can see more clearly what in fact will give us life and what leads to death. May we be blessed to be able to see things for what they really are, to be able to truly see what gives us life, what gives us death, what is good, what is bad. As we find in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 15, where God says, "Behold, I have placed today before you life and death, good and evil." And God tells us there, choose life. It sounds very, very simple. And yet perhaps it is this choice which has eluded humanity since the beginning of creation, and if actualized, would in fact be the ushering in and the reflection of the Messianic era. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.